Talk Show. Recorded live.
And hello, everybody. This is Rick, and it is the 22nd, I think, of
February.
There we go. I've got Aaron in here with me, so let's look at some of the questions we've got today. What do healing processes, let's see, what do healing processes that take as much as up to 5 years have in common? What would be the most important early signs within So if a healing process, let me ask that first question. If a healing process is taking up to 5 years, have in common, typically I would assume that you're dealing with typically for the hurt spouse, I would say there's probably a lot of trauma. And so you've got somebody that's having to deal with trauma issues in addition, which is making it more difficult for them to kind of move forward and where they're still very susceptible to triggers. From the hurt spouse perspective, it would seem like to me, or from the unfaithful perspective, excuse me, it would seem like to me if it's taking up to 5 years, that probably what's happening is that person must be relapsing or something. So I'm not sure, because typically I don't see very many that take that long. So hopefully you're not experiencing one of those. What's one of the early signs for a hurt spouse to let go that the marriage can't be saved? To me, one of the things that you always are looking for is for the unfaithful spouse, kind of, I guess, a willingness to accept responsibility, an acknowledgement that this thing is indeed a problem, not only a willingness to accept responsibility, but a willingness to take action steps, and kind of a continued ongoing acceptance of what this thing was and doing what's necessary just to maintain, to keep themselves safe and to keep their mate safe. If you've got somebody, and if you watch the Changing for Good video, if you've got somebody that doesn't see that they've got a problem, that person to me, and can't accept responsibility for it, that person for me is probably not as safe. The one place I would say anytime there's physical abuse, certainly I would say you don't want to stay around if that's happening within the first, well, at any time. Sometimes I think, you know, if you've given it a long time and your feelings aren't coming back and you've done the work necessary to make that happen, sometimes that's a situation. But that one is a little complicated, and I'd almost want to talk to somebody before they made that decision, because there's a lot of things to do to help feelings to come back. But ultimately, you want to make sure the relationship is safe. So here's one, changing phone number. I think this may be a response from last week. Rick, I understand the need and would have absolutely changed my phone number months ago, but the problem in changing my number is that it is not only my personal number, but it's become both my business and my personal number. Over the past 10 years, I've been building my business using my personal phone as the contact number. It has become the main contact number for my director's position in my other full-time job and that I've had for the past 8 years. My husband thinks it would benefit me to try to contact everyone and give them a new number if I changed it. I feel that would be a tremendous task and don't have the time or the resources to do that. I feel all my work in changing everything just to avoid my affair partner or ex-boyfriend from calling me would be in vain, since my new number would become public again, since it would be on our website and all the other business and advertising that I do. I blocked my AP's number from texting, but Sprint technology currently can't block phone calls. We've come up with a plan. Let our AP know, I have nothing to say to you, please leave me alone, in case our APs contact us. Any comments or what do you recommend? The only thing I would comment on is you might consider splitting your business phone from your personal phone. If you went ahead and got a personal phone, that would not have to be on the website, would not have to be public knowledge. Potentially, I mean, it's the only thought I had of how you would, because obviously the affair partner could certainly call you. I really agree with your plan of what to say, and because there's nothing in there that's got wiggle room. I mean, so I just like the idea. The only thing I would add to that last piece, I have nothing to say to you. Please leave me alone. You might add one more thing. I'm calling my husband and letting him know you contacted me. You might just add that you're contacting your mate as a result so that there's no doubt in their mind that ultimately what you're doing is trying to stay away from them, and you're even kind of throwing them, you know, you're talking to the affair part, or you're talking to your mate about their call. So I do understand the issue with the phone. Like I said, you might just want to split out the work phone from the personal so that if there are calls at night when you might not be taking work calls, you would at least have that privacy. Other family might have another way of contacting you. And hopefully someday Sprint technology will change, because I know that's been a problem for other people. Okay, life, Christian life after an affair.
Can I read a question?
Yes.
I have a reading question. 3 years ago, I found out about my husband's affair with my former best friend. We have made a lot of progress in healing in the past 3 years. I'm trying to understand the deeper meaning behind his affair and have come to something that I am having major problems understanding. My husband was a born-again Christian before his affair. He says that he was always aware that what he was doing was wrong, but he did it anyhow for 10 years. I'm having a hard time comprehending this. In my own life, if I do something that I know to be wrong, I feel a lot of conviction and guilt until I repent and confess. I just don't understand how he could do what he did, all the while seeming to be the model husband, going to things like Promise Keepers, etc., and not feeling so guilty that he would have had to quit the affair. I would appreciate it if you could shed some light on this for me. P.S., just in case you're wondering, he didn't willingly confess his affair. I found out about it 10 years after it was over. 20 years of secrets.
So, there's an article, I think it was last month's newsletter article, and that is relevant here, and it's called Scratch That Itch. And the reality is, if someone gets into something like an affair that where they violate their own conscience, ultimately what happens is their heart's hardened, and they really quit feeling the guilt over time. However, going to things like Promise Keepers and things like that, and the Holy Spirit may begin to convict them. So in a sense, in that conviction, a lot of times they may come forward. Obviously, he was caught. If it had been over for 10 years before you found out, I suspect he was already feeling quite convicted. And there's obviously controversy as to whether or not one should tell. Actually, this next month's news article is addressing that topic, because, I mean, I'm of the opinion that you're far better off to go ahead and tell that there, and it's exactly for this reason, that even 10 years later, there's always the possibility that things come out, and then it leaves someone like you with the struggle of, oh my gosh, you know, they kept secrets now for 10 years. What in the world am I going to do with that? And that's a very, very difficult place. You know, how does he do it? One, I think there's a hardening of heart. And another thought that's going to come back. I'm sorry, I got a cold right now, so I've got a drug-induced fog in my brain today. I can tell I may be talking slower than usual. The other, Stevens, gotta come back. Wait a minute. In my own life, if I do something I know to be wrong, I feel a lot of conviction and guilt until I repent and confess. I just need to understand. Okay, so there's the, I think there's the hardening aspect because it tends to kind of go underground for them and they're able to justify it. That's about the main thing I would say is that there's that hardening piece. I'm sorry, there's one other really good reason, but I, for the life of me, can't think of it right now, and I apologize for that. I'm glad it's over. I'm sorry about the 10 years. Yeah, well, yeah. I'm sure that he was compartmentalizing, too, but maybe he'll come back to me in a second. I'll come back to this one potentially. Sexual addiction. Go for it, Aaron.
Could you please explain why sexual addiction is so difficult to recover from compared to other addictions? That's a good one. Thanks, Dennis.
So the sexual addiction is almost more like the food allergy in the sense that we're probably going to be eating food and we're probably going to be hopefully still doing relationships, still having intimacy. And so it's really a matter of learning. There is no such thing as all you're doing is you're being maybe sober or clean for a particular type of sexual activity, but you've got other sexual activity that ultimately begins to be something different. So it's just like having to learn a whole new way of being. And the other problem with sexual addiction is that so much of the chemical reaction is actually in the brain. So it's not like you have to go buy a beer or there's any type of substance or something like that that would you could just abstain from, which makes it far more difficult. And the I just think that, you know, people that are in recovery, you know, they have to begin by first delineating between what is healthy sex and what is, you know, bottom line, you know, sex that they need to absolutely not be involved with, and what are the middle ranges. And so it's just that whole aspect, I think, that makes it far more difficult because they've never thought of kind of even drawing the lines, oftentimes for them to draw lines. Anger. Let's see, do you want to read that one, Aaron?
Could you please talk about why anger is so destructive to recovering relationships, and what do you recommend in terms of dealing with it? Anger management classes, recovery groups, what do you recommend? Could you also explain about anger being a secondary emotion as well?
Okay, so I recommend, I really like anger management classes or recovery groups, both. I mean, you've got to start by admitting the problem exists. So if we can accept that we have a problem with anger, then actually begin to do something about it. I think if while someone's denying that the anger is a problem, they won't do the class or the group. So I'm assuming we've got someone who says it's a problem. There's a really good book called Men and Anger, if it's a man that's actually having the anger issue. And the author of that book, and I think you can get it through Amazon. I'm looking for my copy right here. There it is. It is by Cullen and Friedman-Longo. And it's Men and Anger, Understanding and Managing Your Anger for a Much Better Life. It's a cognitive behavioral book. We use it a lot in the practice here. And I think that's a great resource for dealing with anger. Anger is a secondary emotion, which is kind of interesting. Typically underneath anger, you're going to find other emotions, secondary emotions such as fear or guilt or inferiority, insecurity, maybe hurt. So in dealing with anger, you've got to begin to look at what's underneath and it's causing the problem. So a lot of times I use this technique where I'll have people, what I call giving a gift. Whenever they get angry, if they'll grab their thumb, G stands for guilt, I stands for inferior, F stands for fear, and T stands for trauma or hurt. And so every time they're angry, I'll have them grab their thumb and start identifying, okay, is it guilt? Because if you think about it, if you ever get pulled over by a cop, a lot of times your first response is anger. Well, you're angry because you're guilty. But we do. We get angry because we get caught. And so that is certainly one aspect of anger. I, inferior. If someone does something that makes me feel like I'm not validated, respected, I may have a raw spot there, and I may just go off all the time. And so I need to understand, because I'd be far better off to say, you know, when you do that, it makes me feel really inferior, insignificant, whatever. Because if you can talk in terms of the secondary emotion, it doesn't escalate the anger. F stands for fear. Frequently when people are afraid, they respond with that fear and that hurt with anger. And then trauma. Anytime we've got a childhood wound, maybe where our boundaries are violated all the time, and somebody does us like we were done in childhood, then we'll immediately flash and go off and hit that pain. That pain will cause us to flood, and then we'll, and I call that transmitting our pain, because like I say, pain that's not transformed will be transmitted. So when that pain comes, then there's a natural tendency to want to transmit it to someone else. So that is a why, you know, oftentimes we say it's a secondary emotion. It's a defense mechanism. It's not a primary emotion. When you pull back the veil of anger, you're always going to find one of those other emotions. Well, almost always. I think there is some kind of righteous anger. An example I can think of is the story of when someone is defending another person. That anger, for instance, may be a righteous anger. If you've got soldiers going across a battlefield, anger may have a real part of you defending your family. So those are important things. Pain. Here's one. What does a couple do when the hurt spouse is in pain, needs to express it, and the unfaithful partner becomes agitated when anything is expressed? One of the things you've got to work on as a couple, because what we're looking for is for the two of you to get to the place where you can ultimately talk about these things rationally. You can have a rational discussion about whatever the topic is. Several things cause the conversation to go negative. One of the things that causes the conversation to go negative is what we call a criticism or a fast startup. Those are actually two things there. In criticism, you're attacking the other person. So, you know, if you start off a statement with being, you know, kind of like, you're such a blah, 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 or you're this or you're that, that is one of the things you can do is try to express it in a way that keeps the unfaithful partner from getting agitated. So you start with I feel statements, oftentimes that helps with the agitation. The other one is fast startup. If you just kind of jump right into the middle of it and just kind of whack them really hard, transmitting that pain, that'll cause them to be agitated. So some of it, I think the hurt spouse can help with a little bit by trying to soften the startup. One of the things that Stephanie used to do with me all the time to help me not get agitated, which I thought was always kind of interesting, is she'd always tell me things like, you know, we need to talk about this, but I don't know that we're going to be able to talk about it without you getting defensive or agitated. And the second she told me that she thought I would get defensive or agitated, I was like, oh, heck no, I'm not going to let you be right. So I refused at that point to get agitated, in a sense. I just said, no, it ain't happening. I ain't getting agitated. And so I would, her warning me before she would begin to talk about it was really an important thing. one, I mean, this is such a huge problem because you may be dealing with someone in the unfaithful spouse who doesn't have enough ego integrity to be able to handle it. Another thing you can do that I think is important is for that person, if they can't control kind of that, if they're flooding every time their mate is talking to them, then I'd highly recommend them get some personal help around you know, their own kind of emotional state to figure out what's causing that emotional elevation where, you know, because a lot of times it feels like on a scale of 1 to 10, your feeler is stuck at an 8, and so you've only got 2 points of movement. So you really want to be able to help that person as a therapist or somebody, to help that person figure out what, how do they calm, deactivate that system, those feelings. So once they're deactivated, then you've got a nice 10 points of movement again. So a small, you doing something that's irritating or whatever to them doesn't immediately cause them to go into agitation. Another thing is safety. When you, what do you do when an unfaithful partner becomes agitated when anything's expressed? I highly recommend that you get pulse watchers and you set the pulse rate at 100 so that an alarm goes off anytime the agitation is ultimately, the person's pulse rate spikes. And the reason that we like to use the pulse watch is that it's difficult for couples to know how to take a timeout. All too frequently in couples, neither good nor bad, it's just reality, one partner is what I call a turtle and the other partner is what I call a shark. A turtle is somebody that when they're processing information, they need to go internal and they like to sit down and be quiet and kind of work through the feelings before they can verbalize what's going on with them. So the way they modulate their anxiety is by kind of withdrawing and thinking, getting space to process. But the other partner may very well be what I call a shark. There's somebody who, the way they modulate their anxiety is by trying to get it resolved, not to kind of analyze it and think about it and process it and get their mind around it. They just want to resolve it. So you've got one person withdrawing and another person coming forward, the shark going, come out, come out, come out, trying to make the turtle talk. And so that's a really difficult type of situation. So the pulse watch, what it does is it becomes a third-party referee so that, and both parties should wear it, because it could be the Hertz, the whoever is, you know, like if the Hertz spouse is really in pain, it may be that they're flooding and they're already over 100, or it may be that the unfaithful spouse is already flooded. If both of you can understand that the other person is flooding, then it kind of allows you the ability to separate, because what research shows is that you're incapable of being able to have a rational conversation if your pulse rate is over 100. So you really want to watch and withdraw from those conversations whenever that has occurred, so that you don't jeopardize the relationship just from continuing to talk when nothing productive ultimately is capable of coming from it. Because that certainly can happen once people begin to flood, and that makes it about 1,000 times more difficult. Okay, that is the last of the written questions. Does anybody online have a question that they would like to ask today? Well, it's very quiet in California over there, or Washington State, or I don't know where the guests are coming from. Okay, well, guys, thank you for all the questions. Let me go back to that one question I didn't fully answer, because I see if I can remember what I was going to say about that one. Excuse me for the quietness here. Probably need to have me whistle while I read it again. Let's see. So how did he do it anyway? This is back to someone who had an affair, but who knew it was wrong. You know, the only other thing that is coming to mind right now, even though I knew I had something else besides this, is in this life, there's always going to be the shadow of the other, something else that we would like besides what we currently have. And certainly, I mean, and I say that simply because even God himself put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden. And even though they had people say, well, was it the marriage's fault? We always go back to Genesis chapter 2 and 3. I mean, even though I assume that they had a perfect relationship with God, they still chose to be unfaithful. And so good relationships, if that's one of the things you're asking, do they preclude us from doing this? I would say absolutely not. If Adam and Eve, who were in a perfect relationship with God, were able to eat that fruit because they thought it offered something to them, that then ultimately I don't see how a marriage in the world could potentially keep somebody ultimately from straying. When someone strays, they can be, I mean, I know a lot of really good people who fall into a lot of really bad things, and all it takes is pride, the ability to believe that it could never really happen to me. If this guy held a secret for 10 years after the affair even, I suspect at one level, I mean, I don't know, that he has a pretty deep shame core, that one of the things that's hard for him is just to be exposed and to walk in the light. That he was really ashamed of what he had done, so that the guilt was there. He just overrode it. And one other thing Paul says in Romans chapter 7, which is really interesting since you mentioned that he was a born-again Christian, he says that once we start trying to be good on our own, that ultimately, and we decide how we're supposed to be, he says sin will seize the opportunity afforded by that law, that commandment, and put us to death. So as human beings, you know, there's only been one human being in the history of mankind, according to my theology, that was able to get everything right. And probably none of us on the phone call today are going to be number two. And it wasn't any of us, by the way. So, in a sense, you know, once I try to be good, ultimately, I just think that I can only go so long in my flesh. And so I think it takes a lot more than just trying to be good. In my mind, it takes a lot more about surrender and an openness, a loss of pride, a move into weakness where I assume this could happen. And so I try to keep from putting myself into a place where something might happen. Let's see. Let me read this question here. I have my running shoes on, but can't leave quite yet, but my unfaithful spouse is lying to others in the family, trying to make me look crazy. The unfaithful spouse is lying to family members, telling something different to each person. How should I handle this till I'm able to leave and get out on my own? You know, what that is called from a clinical perspective is splitting, where someone will give different messages to different people. What you want to do to deal with splitting ultimately is, if you can get all of those people together, even if it's on a conference call or something, and tell your side of the story at one time so that they can all kind of process, then, and they can all talk about how they understood it, then that begins to really expose the fact that they're all getting different messages, But it requires somehow trying to get all the players in there at one time. But that is a great, that's how I typically try to do it if I've got somebody that's been splitting, because I try to bring everybody together and let them talk about what they see. If that's not possible, and if that's not possible, the problem if that's not possible is it's going to kind of be your word against his. So my question then to you would be, because it's not like you need their permission. I don't know if you need their help. I would speak my side of the truth. But if you can't get them all together, it's going to make it really difficult because all they, at that point, it just becomes your word against his. But I would always walk with integrity and try to be as truthful with him as possible. And then over time, I think it will probably come out, even though I've seen this happen before, and it can take a while for family systems to kind of get recalibrated after something like this. Do you need their support? Is that one of the reasons that, and I'm reading chat here, that's why I'm saying this. I wonder, do you need their support to be able to move on? Is that one of the issues here, or is it just the uncomfortable nature of what he's done in terms of just putting family off from you? So I think that's one of the hard things, is that it feels like families ultimately just really start taking sides, and you just feel like you don't have any emotional support. And that's really sad if one party just kind of tries to take the other party's family away from them. So I would hope that's not happening. I would just try to be as honest as possible. If you're at the place of, you may be at a place where you really don't want to say anything negative about him yet. So, you know, the only thing you can do if he's trying to make you look crazy is be absolutely as consistent as you can. Make sure that you call and check on them, see how they're doing. Don't make it all about you. And so if they feel like you're genuinely concerned for them, or you're able to express your concern for them, that way at least their experience of you will be as someone who's very rational and together. So that would be the other thing you might do, is just in those types of phone calls, you know, just the checking phone calls, let them know that what's going on. Let's see here.
Rick?
Okay.
Rick?
Yes.
This is Wendy.
Yeah, Wendy.
Did somebody else try to speak too?
No.
Okay. It wasn't my question, but when you were answering it, the one on anger,
yeah.
Is there, you know, how does one go about finding an appropriate, you know, either recovery group or anger management class or whatever?
You know, believe it or not, at least in Texas, and I assume the case, it would be the case there. First off, I would Google anger management class. Always like Google. The second thing I would do, believe it or not, is call the DA's office, the district attorney's office.
Oh, okay.
Because a lot of times there will be mandated anger management classes that are pretty good, actually, that the court uses for domestic violence. And so that's a great place to go and at least get a referral at the DA's office, even though you may not be dealing with domestic violence. There'll be other people in the course that aren't dealing with domestic violence also, but they certainly would have a list of classes, and that might be really helpful for you.
Okay, yeah, because I hear it suggested frequently, but then I never knew what the, you know.
Yeah, right now, I mean, I know where a couple are in Austin, but
mm-hmm.
I learned of them mostly through the DA, so that's where I go. Any other questions for today? Well, if not, I want to thank all of you for joining us. We had a bunch of states covered today. That was interesting. It's fun to see different states popping in. And I hope you guys have a great week, and I will talk with you then next Monday.
Thanks, Rick.
Okay. The healing, guys. Bye-bye.